You're listening to Rendezvous with a Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to Rendezvous with a Writer, where readers and writers meet, and story is
everything.
We're your hosts tonight, Jim and Bobby Bell. You've been listening to Hot Texas, but a Hot Texas Swing Band with our friend Alex Dormont.
Yes. So who do we have joining us tonight?
We have special guests tonight.
We do. We have special guests.
We have Vince Pinkerton.
Our very first guest steps into the limelight, Vince Pinkerton. Hello, Vince. We're holding up a copy of the book we're going to be talking about in depth.
I see that. Thank you.
How lovely to have you joining us again this year. Thank you for coming back.
Oh, I'm excited to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Where are you joining us from tonight, Vince?
I am joining you from beautiful Fairview, Tennessee, about 20 minutes west of Nashville.
Oh, the heart of music.
Yeah.
Well, before we get started, Jim has a little bio to share, which I think he's going to do right now.
Yeah. Vince Pinkerton is an author and television producer working in the Nashville area. Vince began his writing career in 2021 with the release of his well-received first novel, The Devil Plays Six Strings. The sequel, The Devil and the Nashville Girl, was released a year later. 2024 sees the release of his third novel, Legacy. And speaking of Legacy, we have a little quote from this book. It's kind of a chiller and a thriller.
Chiller and a thriller and a mystery, and yes.
The cold swiftly traveled up the length of his body. His vision blurred as a thin sheet of ice formed over his eyes. He tried to scream, but his tongue was frozen to the roof of his mouth. A wave of cold entered his brain, and he lifted up a desperate, silent prayer. Dear God, save me. If God answered, Curtis never heard him.
Curtis has a hard start at this book. Bless Curtis's heart.
And it just goes on and on. This is riveting prose in this book, Legacy. So again, Vince, welcome. We're so delighted to have you.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
Do you want to get us started on some of our questions?
Well, first, you know, anything in your background you want to talk about I didn't put in the bio? Anything else you want to add to that?
Well, I stay busy. People ask me when I find time to write, and I'm still trying to figure that out myself. But my day gig is a television producer. I've got a small production company here in Nashville. If anybody watching or listening has access to the RFD network, one of the shows that I was production manager over was called Pearly's Place. It was a traditional country music show. That ended about 6 months ago, but now we have a show on there called America's Gospel Music. So we're having a lot of fun doing those. I also oversee programming on a streaming platform called ETV, Entertainment Television. So it's absolutely free. It's on Roku, Amazon Fire, Apple TV. Just search for ETV and you'll find it. Over 10,000 classic movies and TVs and shows. And then a lot of the original programming that we've worked on over the years here in town.
Wow, that's
exciting. Keeps me hopping.
Yeah.
I guess.
So let's talk about Legacy.
Okay.
So what were you thinking? What inspired this book, Vince?
Well, I guess about 4 years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, I was at a business meeting with a client that I do some television work with, and he kept talking about he thought he needed to do a low-budget horror film. And we talked about it. He came up with this idea for a low budget horror film. And I'm not going to tell you exactly what his idea was because it'll spoil something in the book. But I took his idea, and being the type of person I am, I'm thinking, well, if he wants to do a movie, I need to write one. So I sat down just determined to write a script off his idea, and I couldn't do it. His idea was just, it was small. I could not flesh it out. But that was what got me the bug to write again. I had written some in college, but for most of my life, it had been 30-second promos and commercial scripts. But that rekindling of the fire to write in me is what led to The Devil Plays Six Strings, The Devil Dance Hall Girl. So I had started on the third book in that series, which will be out hopefully early next year, called The Devil and the Disciple. And I was working my way through it, but I felt like I was kind of treading over territory I'd already been. I needed to do something before I went back into that series. And I thought, you know, I'm going to try his idea one more time. And I did. I strayed way from where he started. The, you know, 460 some odd page book. But that's where Legacy came from, based off just a small kernel of an idea that I had to figure out how to flesh out and how to get us the story that it ended up being.
Do you want to? Go ahead. Yeah. I think you have a question.
What's happening here? You know, you had to do a lot of research about the book. It seems like
I did.
That, did you get it?
Yes, sir. I had to dig in pretty deep. I tell this story over three time periods. There's an 1870 period, a 1902, and then 2008. I will tell you, I picked 2008 because I think cell phones make things way too easy. So I wanted to set the modern part where he didn't have a smartphone. I wanted to leave some questions there. And, you know, I think with cell phones now, we're too interconnected and it's too easy to find things. But yeah, I had to really dig in to those time periods. The 1870, you know, is that's post Civil War, but that's still very much what we would think of as the Western era. And so I had to dig into surgical tools, which are the center of this story, is a set of surgical tools, and stagecoach routes and stagecoach stations, and just really how things were working at that point. But I didn't want to have total opposite ends of the story in 1870 and modern. So I jumped forward to 1902, which is completely, even though it was only, you know, 30 years difference, the world had changed quite a bit in there. So you know, getting into things on that time period as well. And I like to throw in just little tidbits of things. So there's some stuff in there about a fort that some ladies discovered and found out there was gold under the, you know, under the walls of the fort. I like to just find little nuggets that I can throw in there just to flesh things out as well.
That's good.
Does it relate at all to the first two books? Are there things that connections that you could share if there are?
A little bit. It is not part of the series. It is its own thing. But I love the little world that I created with those two, the first two books. So as I was going through, I found a place that I could put a little backstory on both of those first two books in there. So if you've read the first two, you're going to see some familiar territory here, but it's not part of that series.
Yeah, you particularly have one nasty guy. He kind of, he keeps showing up, doesn't he?
My cowboy.
I know. You had to call him cowboy, right?
I had to. I actually, in the back of my head, I know his name, but that's for a book later on. So we'll just stick with calling him the cowboy at this point. He actually appears in both of the earlier books. In Devil Plays Six Strings, he just makes a really quick appearance to do a very nasty thing to one of the heroes of the book. And then he goes his own way. Devil in the Dance Hall Girl, he is the devil's right-hand man. I like to say he does his wet work. He's the one that goes in and does the dirty work for the devil. He's just so despicable. And I love him. He is a character that doesn't think. He's total instinct, and his instinct is evil.
I just have to ask Vince this question. When, as a writer, when you meet a character like this for the first time, like, did he just enter your world, knock, tap your shoulder and say, hey, I'm here. Write me in this story. How did you and Cowboy meet?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of where it came from. When I was writing the first book, I have certain rules for my characters that I keep in my head. And the devil, who calls himself Mr. Give in the first two books, one of Mr. Give's rules is he does none of his own dirty work. So when we got to a point in that book where something really nasty had to happen to one of the characters, the cowboy showed up. I mean, I'm writing that section. And next thing I know, I hear hoofbeats coming up outside the cabin and he just showed up. And I went, wow, he's awful. I like him. So he's played an important part in all of the books. And like I say, I know his backstory in my head. I know his backstory, and I actually started writing it and got so upset at what I was writing, I put it away. So I've got to decide whether I go back there. If I do his story, it's just awful. Yeah, his childhood and stuff. It's, I may not ever go there. I just really got to decide how deep I want to get.
He's probably not going to let you not do it, Vince.
You're probably right. You are probably absolutely right.
Well, since we're talking about characters, I know that Jim has a favorite question he loves to ask. We should just talk more about characters. You want to ask your favorite question?
Do they ever surprise you?
Oh, they all do. They all do. Especially in... I mean, I'm not alone in this, but I don't outline my stories. I just let the stories tell me where they want to go, and I just tag along. So, yeah, I'll be writing a character, and all of a sudden, they'll just do something I didn't expect at all. Mrs. Gaddis in this book. I don't know how far Jim's got. I know he was a little farther ahead. Yeah, she surprised me a couple of different times. And she goes from a fairly weak start to her character. She's the widow of a Civil War general or colonel, I believe. And she was just there to help me move the story along. And the more I wrote, the more important she became to where, I mean, she really becomes one of the strongest characters in the early part of the book, a strong mother and wife who's just out to watch out for her son and her husband.
Yeah.
She was one that really surprised me in the book. And Calvin Coolidge, not the president, he surprised me too. I needed a scene in the book that would help me explain a little bit of the history of the Civil War toolkit that's central. So I came up with the Coolidge Museum of Medical Knowledge. And had Calvin in there. And the first thing he started doing was stuttering, which I didn't see that one coming at all. And by the time I got through that scene, I realized he has to play an important part. If nothing else, just to put a little comic relief into what's a very heavy book. Mm-hmm. So he makes his way through the rest of the book when I never expected him to get out of about the fifth chapter.
Tell us about Dr. Mitchell.
Dr. Melvin Mitchell. He is, it's like I say, it's post Civil War. He was a Civil War surgeon and has retired into my favorite town, Animas Forks, Colorado, which is very important in the second book as well. And Dr. Mitchell's fate is sealed when a, Indian medicine man who's dying is brought to him in the arms of an ancient Indian spirit. And dropped on his desk, on his table, and basically, saved this man. And he can't. Yeah. But his efforts to do that get him a blessing from the medicine man with his last breath. That blessing turns into a curse. So he's the place where this all begins. With Dr. Mitchell. And then it follows. I'm going to give you a basic, just real quick storyline on the book because we've been hitting around it. The book is the story of a haunted set of Civil War surgical tools that begin with Dr. Melvin Mitchell and mysteriously follow the male bloodline of his family up until 2008. Every time one of his male heirs becomes a doctor of any kind, veterinarian, a dentist, a medical doctor, mysteriously, this set of Civil War surgical tools ends up in their hands. And they become incredibly important in their field. They're innovators. They become wealthy. They become famous. And then they die horribly. So our book takes off there at 2008 when Dr. James Hughes, who has no idea he's any relation to Melvin Mitchell from 150 years before, receives this tools and ends up, after getting some information, especially from a young Native American man named Franklin, he and his girlfriend, yeah, Franklin, Calvin, end up on a cross-country race trying to race ahead of the curse to return the tools to the grave of Dr. Melvin Mitchell before the curse takes them out.
And it is a riveting story. And I know I'm looking at our limelight time. Vince, where can people get the book and where can they find you? Legacy.
Easiest place to get the book is on Amazon. Although you can order it from your local bookstore. You can go in and ask for it to have it special ordered if you're not an Amazon fan. And you can get me, the easiest place is sixstringdevil.com. The number six, stringdevil.com. That's the web place for all of my writing. So you can find out about the first two books as well as Legacy there.
Vince, thank you so much for being with us tonight and bringing this book to our attention. You are part of why we now have a limelight section, is in order to bring past guests on that have new news. So thank you. Thank you for being with us.
It was fun.
Yes, sir. And yes, ma'am. Thank y'all for having me back. And maybe in the spring, we'll try to talk again.
There you go. Thank you.
Okay.
We are going to be joined by our in the center stage spot with author Ken LaSalle. We'll be talking about Cambria. But first, here is a word from Blue Cottage Agency. Find out what they can do for you. Rendezvous with a Writer is sponsored by Blue Cottage Agency and Clicks by Madison, your author publicity and book marketing team. Experienced, trusted, effective. Contact them today at bluecottageagency.com.
Welcome back to Rendezvous with a Writer. We're going to be talking to Ken LaSalle and his book, Cambria. And we're holding it up right now.
That's a really big picture.
I really wanted something to hold up tonight, Ken. So I printed a copy of the cover, the JPEG of the cover. But I'm not really good at technical stuff. Still, we're so delighted to have you with us. Welcome.
Thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Yeah.
We have a little bio. Should we just read this little bio here?
Sure.
Ken LaSalle writes about whatever he darn well pleases. From monologues, philosophies, to worlds you can't imagine. He likes to make you think in ways you might not anticipate. Ken's passion is intense humor, meaningful drama, and finding answers to the questions that define our lives. All right.
And then
want me to read a quote here?
Sure, we're going to do that quote.
This quote here?
Yeah, the first one.
No, or this one.
No, they're going to do this one.
I'm getting some prompts here, as you can tell, Ken.
Obviously, we don't practice.
I'm getting overruled on this one, okay? Well, this goes along with the monologue in Cambria. It's one of the stories you tell. And this particular quote is from the Timeshare Consumer Association. And a lady's being asked a question. And she answers, "Sure, I've been to hell and back. My ex-husband has a timeshare there."
So not a quote directly from Ken, but there is a section in the monologue, and I'm sure we'll chat about it, about his experience with timeshare presentations. And Jim and I have sat through a couple of those ourselves. And so when we were listening to the monologue, it's like, oh my gosh, he's talking about timeshares. And it took us, we began to have our own monologue about timeshares. So yeah, welcome.
They can be pretty interesting.
Yeah, so let's see.
Let's talk about some of the books.
Yeah, you want to tell us a little bit about some of your previous works?
Well, you know, Cambria is my most recent full-length monologue, and the most recent one before that was The World's Worst Backpacker, where I talked about hiking on the PCT, the Pacific Crest Trail. But I wanted to do another one after it, and I wrote a few, and none of them seemed to click. And then, as it happens when you're writing things, I just started writing about Cambria one day, and all these ideas started flooding into my head. And little by little, it came out to be the next thing.
Now, you have written some books. Do you want to talk about a couple before we get in depth into Cambria? Do you want to talk about a couple of your other books?
Sure.
Do you have them handy to hold up to the camera? We'd love to do show and tell. Oh, yes. And that first one that you're holding up, you really wanted to know about work of art. Work of art.
I think it's very, very interesting artwork. So,
yeah. Tell us about that series.
Well, you know, the series Work of Art is about artists, and I've spent my life around artists. I have a background in theater and then, of course, all the writing. And so I wanted to somehow communicate what it was like to be an artist or be amongst artists. And so Work of Art is a book about a series of artists, a group of artists, I should say, who fall in together as they do and somehow find out, you know, get to a point where they understand what their art is trying to tell them, what art is to them. It sounds so pretentious that way.
And there's two in the series so far.
Right now there's two, right? The third one coming out sometime next year.
So did you have to do a lot of research on each of these to
when I got the idea to write these, the first one is the first book is about a kid who draws flowers in a parking lot with a certain kind of paint that I knew nothing about, and I knew nothing about painting. So I actually had to take up a little bit of painting myself just to find out if the ideas I had would work. So after I painted up our driveway a little bit, my wife's a very tolerant woman, and we just watched that age until it finally went away a couple of years ago.
You know, during COVID here in our neighborhood, we saw a lot of people with, you know, chalk out on their driveways and sidewalks. It's very interesting. I haven't really seen it since then, but I think it was that I need to be outside. I need to be outside and I need to be creative. And I don't know if there had been, you know, Instagram things and whatever that got people, you know, doing it. But all of a sudden it was like, wow, there's art all over our neighborhood on the, you know, sidewalks and stuff.
Yeah. Actually, I was inspired to write the book because Vicky and I were driving over the 6th Street Viaduct in Los Angeles, and we were looking down over a playground, over a schoolyard, and children had painted the schoolyard with flowers. And that's where I originally got the idea for that.
That's interesting. I know you have some... I know Jim has some really good questions, and I'm going to shut up so he can ask you one or two.
Who was the artist? Are you the same artist for all the covers, or do you have different artists?
No, actually, for the work of our books, that's one of the few ones that Vicky and I have been putting the covers together for. Mm-hmm. And we're going to actually change the covers with the next book. We're going to revamp the whole thing and do the covers all over again, which is kind of a shame because I kind of like the covers too. But I know that we work with a company called Miblard out of the Ukraine who does some fantastic work. Mm-hmm. And I know they'll create some beautiful covers.
Yeah. Did they do the covers for the Heaven series?
No, that was a separate artist. I was a different artist.
Okay.
Yeah, I've been doing this for a while, and so I have used a variety of people over the years.
Sure.
How did you come up with some of the stories? Do they? You told how you come up with one of them. You were driving over and saw flowers being painted that were painted on the ground. Did have all the ideas come from something you actually seen or witnessed?
Well, it's kind of odd to describe how a writer's mind works, but in the case of this writer, there's stuff always going on. I always have things running through my head. So I always find something. And unfortunately, what happens after you've kind of trained your brain to do that is you will find stuff all over the place and you'll start leaving ideas behind because you just can't write enough.
I did wonder about that, how you catch, you know, do you have a log, you know, an idea hits you and all you need is a cup? No. So if you don't
act on it. Yeah. I use a kind of a Darwinian system where if the idea lives, it stays. If it floats away in my brain, it wasn't that good to begin with.
So do you work on multiple projects at a time? Are you working on more than one? Oh, you are.
Yeah, I'll do a first draft of something while I'm doing rewrites on something else, or I'll do something else while I'm recording in the studio. It really depends on, you know, where I'm at and what I'm free to do. The thing about writing for me is I love doing it so much that I just try to shoehorn in whatever project I can or whatever time I have.
Yeah. So we assume you'll take a real organized approach to which project you start next then?
It really depends on where the passion is. And then if the passion's there, then I definitely structure it out. Depending on what the project is, either I'll write by the seat of my pants or I'll outline it. I'll outline it to the nth degree.
Do you have any challenges writing dialogue?
No, actually, because my background's in theater, most of my writing is dialogue. What I do is I'll write a first draft that's mostly dialogue, and then I'll go back and fill in what I call color, which is all the colors of things, what people are wearing, what people are eating, that kind of thing.
Okay, so it starts with dialogue. Yeah. So then, Ken, are you kind of are you saying it a lot? Are you acting it out as you're writing it, or does Vicky come in and read with you? You know, does she take a role? Or do you make sure that it sounds, how do you know when it sounds right?
After you've run it through your head about 700 or 800 times, you get it. But that really is what it is. You've really got to run it through over and over and over until you get it just right.
Yeah.
Well, you have quite a background, actually, to back up a little bit. When did you actually start writing? And I think you had a day job in there someplace you didn't really care for, too.
Right? Well, I started wanting to be a writer at 17, but the way I was raised, I never really believed in myself very much. So I would write by myself and make sure nobody ever heard about it, or I'd share it with a few people. And I went in directly into from school to getting a job. So I had a problem with confidence. So I went as an author, I did what anyone would do, and I went into insurance. But it took me a while to build up the confidence to where I could lean into my writing craft, and actually it had very little to do with me. It had a lot more to do with Vicky.
Speaking of Vicky, let's shift gears and really get into Cambria. Do you want to just tell us kind of how Cambria came to be and what Cambria means in your life, your lives?
Well, like I said, when I sat down originally to start writing, I didn't know what it would be about. And the fact is, Cambria, the place on the coast of California, it has an importance to our lives. Vicky and I discovered Cambria at a time when pretty much everything was ripe to go wrong in our relationship, in our marriage. Everything was kind of going wrong at the same time. And we both, the monologue is a lot about trust. And we kind of leaned into each other and we decided we would trust each other and we would just make it through. So at the time when everything was going wrong, we decided to take up an offer from a friend of Vicky's to stay at their house in Cambria, which was a big salmon pink Victorian home in Cambria. And we had no money to do anything, and we had very little knowledge of the place, but we had to get away. We had to take a vacation. So that became our kind of little rescue from reality. And fortunately, we had that for a few years. So we had a few memories attached to the place. And once I started writing, it was impossible to hold them back. So once I realized it would become something I wrote, I told Vicky, we need to sit down together and talk about this so we can get, I can get some ideas in my head. And as it turned out, when you're our age and you sit down to remember things, it's a short conversation.
No,
so
Andrea, no, no.
It turns out to be kind of a stream of consciousness, little asides, parentheticals, flights of fancy all around this city of Cambria.
Mm-hmm. I will say, as listeners to the monologue, because it is, even though you do have it available where you can read it, you really want to listen to it. And I think it's on Spotify, and we'll have you tell us where you can find it. But to hear Ken present this, I will tell you that you will immediately be struck by his authenticity, his vulnerability, his sharing really from the heart with a sense of humor about things that we may all, you'll attach to it, because you'll feel that we have a lot in common, and a lot of it is things that maybe we have not spoken, but Ken is speaking it for us. And maybe you, I know that was that was true for us. I'm going to assume it's going to be true for a lot of listeners, Ken.
You know, before you get into Ken, why don't you do a little explanation of audiobooks versus actually a monologue?
A monologue versus,
you know, we have some folks out there that probably don't totally know the distinction. I was trying to explain it to one of our favorite baristas at Dutch Brothers Coffee.
Who likes to know who are you interviewing this week?
Yeah, and I think she's going to be listening tonight. So,
well, you know, I've recorded audiobooks and I've recorded monologues, and there is a difference between the two, because I started writing monologues right around the time of my divorce for my first marriage. Yeah. I just had a lot I had to get out of my system, so I started writing down these kind of stream of consciousness thoughts about life. And one of the ones I did back then was called Driving North. And it was about me driving away from my house once I found out I was going to go through a divorce, and thinking about everything that that would bring. And so that's what brought me to writing them. And then after writing books for a while and after writing plays for a while, I thought, I'm going to start performing things again. And so I did my first full-length monologue, which was called That Olympic Peninsula Lay-By. And then my second one, which again was called The World's Worst Backpacker. And they're really more performance pieces than just reading, as you probably noticed. When I record an audiobook, there's just as much emotion involved, but it's not me. And in the case of the monologues, this is directly coming from my life. So there's a certain weight to it that I wouldn't necessarily attach in a monologue, in an audiobook.
In an audiobook.
Yeah.
So how did you and Vicky meet?
Oh, well, Vicky and I really weren't supposed to end up together. That's the thing about us. We were not meant to be together by any means. We were both on Match.com about 1,000 years ago. And Match.com said, no, neither of you should meet each other. We were definitely not a match. But we can't stick to rules. So we ended up meeting on Match, and we ended up getting on the phone one day. And, you know, before we spoke on the phone for the first time, I remember telling a friend, give me 15 minutes. I was so confident that nothing would go right. There'd be no only endless stretches of silence punctuated by the odd, okay. So I wasn't expecting much. It really wasn't. And then we got on the phone and it turned out to be a lot more than 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. And we really couldn't stop seeing each other. It was just meant to be.
And you had a first date. You know, these are some of the stories that he shares in the monologue. So you have a first date and she's quite a pool player.
Yeah, she was on. We met at Dave and Buster's, that mecca for American fun, in 2004. And I found out she was on a pool team. And I only played slot pool, which was you drink a lot of beer and you see if you can get anything in. So yeah, Vicky was just about out of my league enough when I first met her that I was grateful for punching above my own weight. I had no idea what I was doing. And yeah, this is all in the monologue, of course, but I don't think I've ever been able to be smooth with Vicky. Still, I could be charming with other women in a way I could never manage with Vicky. With her, I'm just me. And she suffers the same malady.
As you should be.
You know, his playing pool with Vicky is kind of like you and I playing backgammon.
Oh, yeah, but we don't want to talk about us.
We played three games and I won as I was teaching her how to play the game. I've never won again.
We don't play anymore. And we are familiar with Cambria, Monterey, and Carmel are three sort of favorite places of ours. Mm-hmm. And I think backgammon was played and never played again in Carmel, I think. Okay, so you talk about something that called the Kissing Library. What is the Kissing Library?
Well, you know, when you're writing a monologue, sometimes story isn't enough. You know, if I was just to tell you we went to Cambria, we had no money, and that's not much of a story. So whenever you're in a relationship for a long time, you tend to run into these thoughts and these, you know, these avenues that you proceed down. And one of them was this idea of a kiss library, a building where the building that holds all of your kisses for later review and retrieval, which actually would just be an app now.
You should look into that, Ken. yes. And then there's this story of the two of you are at Cost Plus, I think it is. And you're both together there, but you know, you've gone, you've gone kind of your separate ways. And then what happens in the wine aisle?
Well, you know, the thing about Vicky, as I wrote this thing, I realized it's not enough just to talk about how we didn't have money in Cambria, but how important Vicky was even long before then. And the best story for me was the story at Cost Plus, when we were both coming down different ends of the same aisle and music is playing overhead. And we both start dancing, which we are not dancing people by any means, but we started dancing. And the weirdest thing was we were doing the same moves across from each other. And this happens sometimes, and we just start giggling and we can't stop.
And this monologue is just full of these wonderful stories. Does she like cows?
There's a couple cow stories in the monologue. And the best thing is I just heard from a friend of mine that he, whenever he sees a cow as he's driving along, it's exactly what he thinks of. And so that's a nice little accolade. But my wife loves cows. If we're driving by any place that has cows, just hanging out, you know, doing their thing, cowing around, Vicky will yell as loud as she can, often in my ear, "Cow!" And God help your ears or my ears if she sees cows running, because the piercing scream of "running cows!" It deafens you for a while.
Yeah, she must not have grown up on a farm. She probably encountered a cow in a later life.
No, well, actually, she grew up in Antelope Valley, where, by the way, there are no antelopes, but they do have plenty of farms out there.
Yeah, they do.
So
they
she just has a love for things that she will later have for dinner.
So in the monologue, you, as I said, you're very authentic and you're very vulnerable. You're laying out all kinds of things, sharing this story. And obviously, Vicky has heard it many times. I'm assuming, did you run things by her? Did you say, "Honey, is it okay if we talk about you and cows?" You know, or did she say, "Oh, you got to put in some cows"?
No, actually, Vicky is a pretty hands-off dictator. She has a full veto power over anything that I release that has her in it. And I released a few things that have her in it. And I didn't mention anything ahead of time, except maybe I think I'm going to write about Cambria. And of course, we talked about what happened when we were in Cambria. But aside from that, it wasn't until I had it recorded and done. Actually, I had it recorded and done, and then I got long COVID. And I spent a year with this copy that was recorded and done. And what happens is after you spend a year listening to something, you pick out every possible mistake that's in it. So I was kind of blessed by getting long COVID because I had to hear my mistakes over and over, and I fixed every single one, and I made Cambria my best thing ever. And I'm just so very proud of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
How do family members feel about your work? Do you have much conversation with them about it?
Oh, yeah. They tend not to really understand what I do.
Okay.
But I found the strange thing is even though I, for the longest time, I had imposter syndrome, I think they call it. I really couldn't admit to being a writer. I didn't think I was a big enough writer or anything. Okay. But people just kept saying it, and I had to accept it. And they, there's a certain... People look at me sometimes like I'm some kind of shaman or something because I do this thing that's so out of the ordinary and so bizarre that I will sit down and just type on a keyboard. But I've kind of grown to like it.
It sounds like you have a lot of fun with what you do.
Oh, I wanted to create art from a very young age, and I didn't really know how. I mentioned in the monologue that originally, when I was a kid, we listened to a radio show when I was 9 years old, and I thought it was the actors who made the radio show so great, and that's what made me want to be an actor.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It was only later I found out that you had to have good lines.
Mm-hmm. We are going to continue our conversation with Ken, but we're just going to step away for a moment, and we're going to show you, here's one of the places that you can find all of the work of our guests on Rendezvous with a Writer, including Vince's books. I do have some of your books. Your earlier books, Ken, are also on bookshop.org, our affiliate page out West Shop on bookshop.org. So take a listen, and we'll be right back with Ken. Don't go away. Story is everything. Find a great one on Out West Shop's Bookshop. Go to outwestshop.com, find books and CDs on the menu, choose Shop Out West on bookshop.org. Browse through featured authors on Rendezvous with a Writer. Explore curated book lists and our featured picks. Add in note cards, calendars, and jigsaw puzzles. One-stop shopping for great gifts. Use the search box to find thousands more titles. Make the switch. Your purchase supports us as independent booksellers. That's our story.
Welcome back to Rendezvous with a Writer. We're talking with Ken LaSalle, and we're talking about his monologue, Cambria. You know, you did have quite a little bit in there about timeshares. Did you want to talk about that at all?
Actually, I've kind of pulled aside a little excerpts that I can read for you, because I talk a lot about, you know, a lot about trust in the monologue, and we'll get to that. And one of the first ways that I really had to trust Vicky was by going to these timeshare presentations, because I thought they'd be terrible. I mean, when I was in my 20s, I'd be barely scraping by with some guy in a suit asking me if I could afford to provide my bride with the quality vacation she deserved. And then 6 months to a year later, with the possibility of winning an all-expense-paid trip to Blythe on a Thursday in August, I'd sit in front of another sweaty suit asking me what my problem was anyway. Why did I hate my wife so much that I wasn't willing to give her the vacation that she'd always wanted since 10 minutes ago? My attitude towards timeshare presentations wasn't exactly the most positive.
Absolutely.
But the best thing was, is with that first timeshare presentation that we went to, Vic and I decided to make it a joke and just have fun with it and just be there just for whatever free gifts we could possibly get, while all at the same time mocking the people trying to sell us things.
Yeah, you know, the first time we went to one, whenever that was, well, but I can remember, you know, you get in the room, the door shuts, you think you hear the click of the locks, you're not going to get out.
Yeah.
Yeah, you got to have the hermetic seal.
Do you have something that you wanted to read or no?
Well, no, actually, I can keep going, because, you know, we were called back to another timeshare presentation just a little while ago, and we had to go just for research purposes. So I can tell you that the pitch, the presentation, even the high pressure tactics are all the same. The locations are the same. Many of the sales staff are the same, just the way you remember them. And if you've seen one, you probably see them again because timeshares don't go after kids anymore. Oh, no. What hardworking person in their 20s or 30s actually has money these days? No. Timeshare presentation folk know who has the money. And that's why they brought me in with Vicky for our golden years. So we could spend them surrounded by all the best con artists available just in time for Alzheimer's. So the people who would once heard the same load in their 20s or their 30s, heck, maybe into their 40s, can have something to spend their reverse mortgages on. I had so much fun going to that meeting and knowing that I'd be able to talk about this thing that had hounded me my whole life, these timeshare presentations. There's such a I'm not going to say it.
You suppose we have any timeshare sales folks listening?
We might.
If they're listening, I feel really bad for them because they've got a really tough job.
So let's see, Ken, how do you handle writer's block? Do you get it or not?
I do. I had it this summer. It was terrible. It was the worst feeling because when I used to hear about writer's block, I thought writer's block was, gee, I can't think of what to write. Oh, well. But what writer's block really is your brain just shuts down. It's total burnout and you can't do anything. And I thought I was looking over here at what I wrote down about writer's block. I said, you feel like an inability to write strips you of who you are. But in reality, it's the moment to rest, to breathe, to somehow relax, despite what must be a true certainty that you will never be able to write ever again. But that's what I had to do. I had to just trust that things are going to work out. And take a little time off, which I actually really, really enjoyed.
Yeah.
All right.
Is there, do you find joy in writing?
Oh, it's, there are no words. When I was young, writing was really easy. And I would go and write columns on this paper, or I'd write something over here. And I would always mock the activity of writing because it was something I could do without even thinking about it. I do it with one hand tied behind my back. But as I've gotten older and it's become more of my life, I realize just how much of my life it is and how much of me is in that work and how it becomes so profound. It just is absolutely beyond words.
I'm looking at our time. Did you have a quick question? I'm looking at time.
Yeah, we might. I think we need to ask Ken where to find him.
Where to find you? Yeah. Where do people find you, Ken?
Well, you can find me on kenlasalle.com and Ken LaSalle on Instagram and Facebook, KenLasso. It's right down there. So, and you can find my books on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, wherever books or audiobooks are sold online.
Yeah. This was so much fun, and truly everybody listening, where can they pick up the monologue? Where do they go?
Cambria, you can stream it anywhere books are streamed online, download it wherever you find audiobooks online, Spotify, audiobook.com, Audible, all the big names. And
you have Spotify and Alexa. If you have Spotify and Alexa, you can probably say if you say play Cambria, I tried this the other day, you get like a group of musicians. You probably have to say, do you have to say Ken LaSalle?
You Cambria? Probably have to say play Cambria by Ken LaSalle
there.
On Spotify.
There you go.
Don't forget
there
to say the service that you're on.
And speaking of streaming, if you are joining us tonight live, you can catch this again as a podcast. You can get it both the audio and the video. On Podbean, you can get the audio. I'll be posting it later this evening. This is episode 107, and we really want to thank our guests, Ken, who is still on screen with us, who, again, is a wonderful writer, and also we've been talking about the monologue Cambria. And then our first guest, Vince Pinkerton. I'm just reaching for a legacy, and we thank Vince again for being with us tonight. Next week, Jim and I are heading out of town, and Tom Swearingen, our good friend Tom Swearingen, is coming back to guest host. And he is bringing with him a fabulous Western writer. Rick Stieber will be with him on next week. And then the following week, Halloween night, In the Limelight, we'll be back. And In the Limelight will be Catherine Brown Ransberger. And we'll be talking about her book, A Thousand Flying Things. And then we go across the pond, as they say, and we'll be talking to our singer, songwriter, recording artist friend, Clint Bradley. And that will be closing out the month of October. On October 31st.
Yeah.
So you have a final quote that you
We
have one final quote.
We're working this in here.
Okay.
It's just from the monologue. I've been writing since I was 17, and I'm not nearly 60. For almost all these years, except maybe 10, I couldn't stand my work. I hated it. As soon as I had written something, I'd fast go to the next thing in hopes I'd fall in love with it. Keep writing. Fall in love with other people's work. Fall in love with your work. Do whatever it takes to fall in love, as that will inspire what you do. That's it.
Thank you, Ken, for being with us tonight.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Until we meet again.
It's always a great day.
Out west, keep writing. We'll keep reading.